Conversation, letters, elementary books. But his own draft had concepts not so common, and he felt anguish when his particular views were expunged. The draft claimed, for instance, that amity was the basis of American union with England, that this amity was betrayed with a stab to agonizing affection, one delivered by unfeeling brethren, forcing Americans to renounce our former love. This language fit well with his later writings, which emphasized the social bonds of moral sense. It was widely recognized that these later writings drew on the thinkers of the Scottish Enlightenment. Why had this not been recognized as a source for the Declaration? For two reasons, I believed. Because attention had been almost exclusively devoted to the Congressional Declaration, not Jefferson's draft, and because Jefferson's first library had perished in the fire at his plantation on February 1, 1770. Had that library survived, I argued, it would no doubt have indicated the source for Jefferson's establishment of amity as the basis of social obligation. That language did not just appear from nowhere. Despite Jefferson's admiration for Locke as an icon of the Enlightenment, the author of the Essay Concerning Human Understanding, and despite his close dependence on his Epistle on Tolerance, I did not find him arguing with a similar closeness from the Second Treatise on Government. On a key Lockean concept like property, for instance, Jefferson relied heavily on the Scot, Lord Kames, never departing from Kames despite Kames' departures from Locke. I was reacting to exaggerated claims of Lockean dominance, but I exaggerated in the opposite direction, and I erred when I wrote, "There is no indication Jefferson read the Second Treatise carefully or with profit." Indeed, there is no direct proof he read it at all, though I assume he did at some point. One of the earliest reviews, that by Edmund Morgan in the New York Review of Books, proved that was wrong, though he did not think this oversight falsified my larger argument. In fact, he concluded, "No one has offered so drastic a revision or so close or convincing an analysis as Wills has." The Declaration did not cite the Second Treatise, but it clearly echoed it in these words: "Mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism," Locke's words were, "People are more disposed to suffer than to right themselves. But if a long train of abuses, prevarications, and artifices, all tending the same way, make the design visible to the people," this resemblance has to do not with fundamental political philosophy, but with the particular propaganda of what Richard Ashcraft calls the Second Treatise's language of conspiracy. But that is beside the main point, that I certainly missed a blatant instance of Jefferson's using Locke in the Declaration. For many, especially those who had an emotional investment in the Becker thesis, which they had been teaching or repeating for decades, this was enough to discredit the whole argument for Jefferson's reliance on Scottish concepts. In a long article for the William and Mary Quarterly, October 1979, Ronald Hamowy took the Declaration phrase by phrase to show that Locke was as good a source as, or a better one than, anything in the Scots. Some of these parallels are commonplaces, like the right of revolution against a tyrannical government, which every thinker to the left of Filmer granted, even a Tory like Samuel Johnson. Nonetheless, his argument is fair enough, with one fatal limit. Though he admitted that I was dealing with Jefferson's draft, he restricted his own discussion to the congressional document, sliding around the telltale later references to things like amity, wounded brethren, stabbed affection, and former love, things far more specific than the right of revolution. Even if the earlier passages can be traced to Locke,